Well, we didn't finish last week, so you have last week's handout, and you're welcome to look at it. But I knew some of us would somehow in the week misplace it and not bring it back. So I've included the last part of that as the first part of this week's handout sheet. So that'll kind of help get us oriented. This is lesson 7, although we're going to review a little bit getting into it. I thought I had that all straightened out too. Let's see. Not that one. We're not going to go back and review the gift of discernment, but we are going to talk about tongues and interpretation of tongues today. And I'll just push this slide up here. I don't need to read it for you, go over it. Just note the change on the bottom. The gifts of tongues and interpretations form their own group. They're grouped in the third class in 1 Corinthians 12:10. And here's 1 Corinthians 12:10. To another of a different kind, last class, different kinds of tongues, to another, the interpretation of tongues. So here's the breakdown in kind of a more of a chart-like form. You see it there. They are in that third class. Again, 1 Corinthians 13:8, we're going to come back to this in a few minutes, so I'm not going to elaborate on it, but prophecies, knowledge, and third class. Knowledge, first class, listed third here. Prophecy, second class, representing that second class, listed first here. Tongues, representing the two tongues interpretation in third class in the middle. So let's talk about the gifts of tongues and interpretations. The gift of tongues interpretations. The word translated tongues, we covered this last week, we've covered it before, again in review. The word translated tongues is the Greek word for language. It's the normal term that was used to refer to any particular language that was referenced, in general, a language. We also saw in Acts 2 that there was another word. The word translated languages there was also supplemented by a Greek word meaning dialect. In other words, a subcategory of a particular language. Any particular language will have different dialects. As here in America, our English is a dialect of the old English in England, right? And within America, I know I grew up in Appalachia, we have our own dialect. And we grew up here, a lot of their own dialect. They say things differently, talk different, they have different words that mean different things. And I found the same here in Texas. Not so as extreme as in North Carolina. I don't know. They think they got the top reward on that. Okay? Secondly, the gift of tongues was a sign for unbelievers. And we began this last week. We talked about it a little bit. We go to 1 Corinthians 14, 21-22. And that's going to, chapter 14 is going to be where we're going to live this evening, or this morning. But we jump into the end of chapter 14, basically, or toward the end of it, to get our directions, our bearings. Tongues, Paul says, are a sign not to those who believe, but to unbelievers. This we have to keep in mind. I emphasized this last week. Tongues was not just a miracle that overcame language barriers. In fact, it didn't really need to overcome language barriers. Because everyone throughout the Roman Empire spoke the language of the empire, which was Greek, in addition to their own home language. The Romans spoke Greek, but they also spoke Latin, I guess it was, Italian, whatever you want to call it. The Jews, they learned Greek, although they spoke in the south, mainly Hebrew, in the north, Aramaic, and a mixture in between, and so on. So there were commonalities through the Greek language they could all understand. In fact, when Peter preaches the sermons in Acts, which thousands come to believe, he's preaching in Greek. But when you go back to chapter 2, where it does not give us the text of what they said, they're speaking in languages or tongues. The point of that was, here was a Galilean who spoke Greek. He spoke Aramaic primarily, could speak Greek, probably could speak Hebrew, which could have been communicated with any of those Jewish believers throughout the empire that were there. But he spoke in something that he didn't understand. Their particular dialect, or their particular language in some cases, he may not have known. And that was a sign to them. It was a sign that worked both ways. It was a sign to Peter that something was happening here as well. So, tongues were a sign to unbelievers. That's what we just saw in 1 Corinthians 14:22. It was a sign that confirmed the gospel to unbelieving Jews. We saw that in Acts 2. We're talking about all the people gathered there for the Feast of Weeks. It specified Jews and proselytes from throughout the whole empire. Now, there would have been some Gentiles there, but not a lot compared to all the native Judeans, those from Galilee that had come, those from Jews from out the empire that had been, you know, dispersed about for business or whatever, flocking back. That was the huge population of them there present. So, well, they know a Galilean when they hear a Galilean. They knew these guys were Galileans. They were not unknown. They were probably being talked about. And now they're speaking in dialects they understand, but they know Galileans don't speak. There's a sign there. And it is a sign that confirmed the message of Christ, the gospel, the truth of these apostles that they were speaking to those who never heard of Jesus. Or if they heard of him, didn't know much about him. And even if they heard of him, and even if they knew a little bit about him, they weren't ready to cash in what they'd lived all their lives, which was traditional Judaism, without some sign. We also noticed, well, I talked ahead of this, just a quick reference here. 1 Corinthians 14:21, I will speak to this people, he says in verse 21. Then he says it will be a sign to unbelievers in verse 22. Well, who are this people? Well, this is all a quote that Paul took from Isaiah 28:11-12, in which definitely he's talking to Jews. Isaiah was not talking to anybody but Jews in that prophecy. And I also referenced this just a minute ago. They were dwelling in Jerusalem, not living there permanently, but they were there dwelling in the moment for a while during this long feast in Jerusalem, Jews and devout men, which means proselytes. In some cases, just Jews who were devout, but down here he specifies, after naming all these regions, both Jews and proselytes. Proselytes were Gentiles that had come to be Jews by belief or religion, and then had come to the festival as well. So, confirming the gospel to the Jews, but also confirming acceptance of the gospel to Jewish believers. We mentioned this, and I think we covered it quickly last week. In Acts 10, Cornelius, the Roman Gentile, the Roman centurion that Peter was sent to preach the gospel because he saw that vision in Joppa, Peter rise and kill, clean and the unclean. He then receives a sign from the Gentile who becomes a believer, Cornelius, that he really truly is a believer because Cornelius and his family speak in tongues. Then the tongues sign goes both ways. In Acts 19, same case with Paul when he dealt with believers in John the Baptist, and again Judaism as John the Baptist was preaching within that context, but they hadn't heard of Jesus. He gets that confirming sign when they speak in tongues. So, that brings us to C, and let's see if I can somehow lift this up so you can see it again. We have time to get all the adjustments this morning. Well, you can read it on your sheet. I'm not having a good time with it this morning. But we're down to C here, which we're adding. And I think this we referenced last week. You may even got it on last week's handout. We didn't talk about it much. So the next thing we want to add to our outline, means languages, was for a sign. Therefore, tongues ceased before the other temporary gifts. Why therefore? Because the need for a sign to the Jews ceases before the church matures. Now let me explain that. But first let's go back to chapter 13 of 1 Corinthians, verse 8, and remind us of something I mentioned way back in the beginning, the first week or two. Here Paul says, love never fails, but whether there are prophecies, they will fail. Whether there are tongues, they will cease. Whether there is knowledge, it will vanish away. Now, there's a representative of each of those three classes in 1 Corinthians 12, which is the previous chapter, mentioned here. Prophecies, tongues, and knowledge. Of the first one, prophecies, they will fail. That's the English translation. I think I got New King James up here. That's in the active voice. Now we use active, passive, middle voice in English too, but it's not noted as we write like it's noted in the Greek with the word index. But we use it. And so if I take my dog for a walk, I'm active. I'm the one taking the dog. I'm the one making the decision. I'm the one determining the route. I am taking my dog for a walk. That's active. So prophecies, they will be made to cease. Something actively will impact them to make them cease. And that, we believe, is the completion of the New Testament, the maturity of the church, as we've discussed previously. Let's drop down to knowledge. Knowledge will vanish away. It's different in the New Testament translation. This just bugs me every time I see it, and all translations do it. They'll translate the same word differently in the same context, but it's the same exact Greek word. Will fail, will vanish away. It's active. Knowledge will be actively, by something acting upon it, made to cease, which means literally rendered inoperative or rendered obsolete. That will again be the completion of the New Testament and the maturity of the church. In the middle here, we have this phrase about tongues. Whether there are tongues, they will cease. Now, it's different here than here and here. I'll grant the translators that. But it doesn't really indicate something about this verb. It's middle voice. It's designated so in Greek. So, if I take my dog for a walk, I'm active. But if my dog takes me for a walk, I'm passive, right? By the way, passive and middle in Greek are the same. It's determined by context. So it can't be passive here, because they go away. They don't go away, you know, because of something active upon them. It's determined by context. This is middle voice. So if I take my dog for a walk, I'm active. If my dog takes me for a walk, I'm passive. Because my dog decides where to go, and he's leading me around, which is not all that unusual. Even though she's a little dull, very determined. But middle voice means I leave my dog at home and I go for a walk for me. I'm doing it for me. I'm taking me on a walk, which is pleasant. More pleasant than walking the dog for me, for sure. So this is middle voice, meaning that Nothing makes tongues pass away, but tongues passes away in and of itself, like I take myself for a walk in and of myself. What is that? Well, this is the reason why I say tongues passed away before the others. Because what is it that we can identify as transition period that would cause tongues to come to a conclusion before? What did the translation period, or when did the translation period, give me another cup of coffee. When did the transition period for Israel elapse? That's the question. Because tongues, we already know, was a sign for Israel. So what in Israel's history would tell us tongues would pass away at an event that would precede the completion of the New Testament? I'm going to tell you the place, I think, and tell you why in a moment. At some point between 55 and 100 AD, I believe is when this happened. The others passed away more around circa 100, when the New Testament was completed with the book of Revelation. What point did tongues, if tongues is before 100, then it'd have to be, I have to have a starting point back here, and I list, I don't know the starting point, but I put 55 AD because I know it's not before that, because Paul wrote 1 Corinthians about 55, 56 AD. We know that. And Paul's talking about him being there. So sometime between 55 AD and 100 AD, they went off the scene in and of themselves. I'm going to suggest, and I don't know this is an exact date, or it could be pinpointed, or even the event necessarily highlighted, but I think it's pretty probable that it was circa 70 AD or around 70 AD. Why? What happened in 70 AD? The Jewish nation, for all official practical purposes, came to an end. They destroyed the temple. There was no Jews coming from across the empire to celebrate the Feast of Weeks. There was no temple to sacrifice. All that was that made up Israel as a nation, which is, you know, completely intertwined with its religious identity, is gone. Doesn't mean the tongues wouldn't need to be exercised after that, perhaps, because Jews would be coming into churches around the empire, perhaps, but and we don't know the end point, but we do know it's sometime around 55 AD, it's sometime between 55 AD and 100 AD, because by the midpoint there, Israel's no longer a nation. And at least for a time after 55 AD to, if it was 70, another 15 years or so, to the Jews who came into churches. I know this is a lot for all of us to kind of grab this morning, this early. But.
So going back to 1 Corinthians 13, 8, then when he says, referring to tongues, they will cease or will be still in the NIV. That was really Paul's prophecy.
That's how we know. That's a prophecy to him. He doesn't pinpoint it. But he tells us just in the minute voice of a verb that it's before the other. That's how precise the word of God is. Other than that, we don't have anything else to tell us that it wouldn't be associated with the other two if it's in Paul. Okay, now let's move on to D in your outline. I don't think this was on last week's handout sheet, but it's on this week's. So if you're following one from last week, you need to switch over. The problem in Corinth was the misuse of the gift of tongues, or the gift of languages, known languages. The problem in Corinth was the misuse of the gift of tongues and does not establish that the gift consisted of unintelligible speech. It does not establish that it ever consisted of unintelligible speech, but known languages. The unfortunate thing is, the King James Version, back in the 1500s, inserted the word unknown before the word tongues in its translation. Even though they put it in italics, most people don't process. Italics means it's not in the original text that was inserted by the translators because they just thought it was unknown. They didn't understand the theology. Unfortunately, and double unfortunately, every English translation since then has approached 1 Corinthians 14 with that same thought in mind. Now, many of them have taken out the word unknown completely, as the New American Standard does, that we're going to look at in a minute. But it still retains interpretive words which imply it, unfortunately. And on top of that, most unfortunately, most cessationist interpreters still think that unintelligible language is a part of 1 Corinthians 14. And so they try to distinguish in there what's unintelligible and what's the real gift, and it just becomes a confusing quagmire. My approach is, and I think I have every reason to see it this way, there is no mention of unintelligible, ecstatic, unknown speech. There's no such thing in 1 Corinthians 14 about people talking to God in a heavenly language. It's all talking about what the word means. Known languages. Now, I'm going to go through 1 Corinthians 14. I gave you a text, 1 Corinthians 14, verse 19, 20 verses, whatever it is, with my notes in it. On your copy, my notes are in the parentheses. That's not scripture. On the screen, my notes are in highlighted yellow. That's not in the scripture. But I didn't want to use copy ink to do all yours in color. So, sorry about that. I know how much color copies cost the church. Could have done it, I guess. But anyway, just remember, in parentheses, that's my commentary. On the screen, my commentary is in yellow highlighted. Now, why is it so important to go through the details of 1 Corinthians 14? I'm going to tell you why. Years ago, when I was pastoring my first church in West Virginia, I had a young man about my age. I guess I was pretty young too. He pastored a Baptist church in the county that I pastored a Baptist church. Mine was an independent Baptist church. He was a Northern Baptist pastor. But he was very, very independent in thinking. And for some reason or other, he resigned his church and he came to my church, and he and his wife, to attend for a while. Got to know him. Good God. Good solid. At some point, he realized he needed some education. Theological education. So I recommended to him the school that I went, although he'd be entering into the college. I didn't go there till seminary. He went, he basically washed out the first semester. I don't really know all the reasons why he didn't stick with it. So he never got a foundation. He came back to West Virginia, got back in the Northern Baptist Church, was pastored another church or two, got out of the ministry. Lost track of it. Nearly 25, 30 years later, he suddenly popped up on my Facebook page. Now, don't go looking for my Facebook page. I never post anything on it. I just have it there so I can see what other people are doing. I don't have the time. Don't have the desire to do it. But it really, as a pastor in particular, helped me know what all was going on. So that's how your pastor snoops on you guys. Knows what's happening in your life. Suddenly he pops up and sends me a message on Facebook. He's pastoring a charismatic church in Virginia. What? Doesn't this guy know better than that? I mean, I'm not criticizing those who are charismatic in persuasion, but I thought he thought like I thought, like most Baptists thought. What changed? Probably somebody took 1 Corinthians 14, put it in front of him and said, see. And that's apt to happen to anybody that doesn't have a grasp of what I'm about to show to you. You can take everything we've looked at so far. You think you can believe everything I've told you, accept it all. And you turn around and read 1 Corinthians 14, you're going to doubt it. You don't understand 1 Corinthians 14 in the right context. I've looked at it for years thinking, man, that doesn't sound like what I believe and what I'm seeing elsewhere. So I know this is academic, and I know it's probably a little bit boring, and believe me, I'd rather be preaching where I can focus on practicalities and applications more. But you see, this is why pastors don't preach 1 Corinthians 12, 13, and 14 much, is because there's such a foundation to be laid here before you can do it. I spent all my ministry trying to figure it out. I had some of it along the way, even early on, and added more over the years. But it's a long, hard process to lay the foundation. So in, generally speaking, in evangelical circles, it's not dealt with much. But we begin here. The problem in Corinth was the misuse of the gift of tongues. The actual tongues, known language, same thing you see in Acts 2. See, the charismatics try to say, well, what you see in Acts 2 is different from what happened in Acts, or in 1 Corinthians 12, 13, 14. How can it be? Same words are used. There's no justification for making the change to some unknown heavenly language to what was something understood by people in Acts 2. There's no justification for that. So there's some interpretive principles you have to carry into chapter 14 of 1 Corinthians. And if you don't carry these interpretive principles into chapter 14, you will not understand chapter 14. Worse than that, if you don't carry these interpretive principles into chapter 14, you'll probably be tempted to forget about everything I've already told you. That's not going to affect your salvation or make you less of a Christian or unusable in the kingdom of God. But I just think it's my job to try to make clear what's there. So that's the best I can do to do that. Every time the word tongues occurs in 1 Corinthians 14, it refers to a known language. Why? Same word you see in Acts 2. Same way the Greeks used it in their culture. It's what the word meant in the original. No reason to insert unknown in your thinking. It refers to a known language or dialect not known by the one speaking. There is an unknown aspect to tongues, but the unknown part was that it was unknown by the person speaking the tongue. It was intelligible to those hearing it. If it wasn't intelligible to those hearing it, it wouldn't have been a sign, right? They didn't know what it meant. I go into a restaurant, walk-ons out here. I've seen so many TVs in a restaurant in my life. Then they're all gone. I think they've got the sound turned off, but the 100 people in there with me don't have their sound turned off. It's just, I can't hardly talk to someone across the table anymore. It doesn't make any sense to me. It doesn't do you any good to hear something you can't understand. It's not a sign if you can't understand it. So, it's unknown only to the one speaking it, because they hadn't learned it. That's the miracle. Number two, interpretive principle. The purpose of the gift of tongues is to provide a sign to the people of Israel. We've already covered that. It comes after what we're going to deal with in 1 Corinthians 14 in a minute. Known languages, sign to Israel. You've got to have those two in place. If you don't have that in place, you will never understand chapter 14. You will just absorb what you think or what it may seem to say in English or what some commentary says. And believe me, you can find enough commentaries that are totally confused on this, they'll confuse you. Just because you pick up a commentary don't mean you should believe the commentary. You should know who wrote the commentary, what their theological perspective is. Diane used to wonder, why do I go to the back cover before I open a book? I want to see something about the person writing the book before I waste my time on what's in the book. If I already know a person's perspective, I'm not going to read the book if it's different than mine. I know it's hard to do when you're young coming up, but when you've seen it all before, you can do that. Okay. Third interpretive principle, when the tongue was spoken in a local church, this is not in Acts 2, this is later on, Paul, 1 Corinthians, when the tongue is spoken in a local church and the language was not known by those present, an interpreter was required. There were people in the church, not just Paul, but members in the church who come to Christ that came from Greek backgrounds, who were Gentiles, members in the church in Corinth that had come to Christ from pagan backgrounds and from Jewish synagogues who become part of the church through faith in Christ, that had the gift of tongues that they could use to be assigned to other non-believing Jews. At least until AD, circa AD 70. So when one of these people exercised their gift of speaking in tongues in a local church, Paul put a limitation on it. He said, don't use the gift without an interpreter. And this interpreter was required for those who were like the person speaking. The person speaking in the tongue doesn't understand the tongue, doesn't know what the words mean. That's the miracle. It's unknown to him. It's known to the Jewish people who hear it, or the people in the dialects in the different parts of the empire, but they may not know. The unknown part is on the speaker. So if someone speaks, for them to be edified, they need to know interpretation. It's not interpretation, so the unbelievers coming in will know, because they're hearing it in their own language. The interpretation is for the speaker and those like the speaker who only know the language the speaker speaks. If you don't unravel that, going into 1 Corinthians 14, you're lost. So let's try looking at 1 Corinthians 14. And here's where I provided you the text. Now, you can look at the printed text I gave you. If you want to, you can make notes on it as we go, if you'd like to do that, to give you further elaboration of my comments. But you might just prefer to put it aside and look at the screen and use it for a reference later. You can do it either way. Because what you see on the screen is what's on your text, but I'm going to add comments. So Paul says, pursue love. Going way back to chapter 13, it's been his topic. Pursue love and earnestly desire spiritual gifts. Now he's talking to the church because this is a plural here. The verb is plural. Pursue love, yet earnestly desire spiritual gifts, but especially that you may prophesy. Now that's another spiritual gift, and we're not going to go into that again. We've already covered that. Verse 2. For the one who speaks in a tongue does not speak to people. Whoop. That makes no sense at all unless contextually you understand the situation and the context. Paul's talking to a church. He's talking to a church body. And he's talking about using a gift that's assigned for people that don't believe, so he's not speaking to people who do believe. Right? So he's not speaking to people when only people of like language that believe in the church are present. You're not speaking to those people because they don't understand the tongue. But he's speaking to God. Why? Well, when God's present, where two or three are gathered, God's always there, right? Jesus is always there. And God doesn't need an interpreter. What I mean? So whatever he said, God understands it. So he's not speaking to the people there who are like him in his language, but he's speaking to God. He's the only person that could be hearing it. Right? Because God is the only one present who understands. For no one understands, but in his spirit, without personal comprehension, that is, he speaks mysteries. Now, the "for no one understands" goes with this. But to God, here's the explanation for no one understands, but God. But in his spirit, that means in your immaterial part, your, look, body, soul, spirit. Basically, it's material and immaterial. The immaterial part of us is either soul or spirit. There's a further division made there. In our spirit, that doesn't die when our body dies, although our body will eventually live again as well. Our soul goes to be heaven or hell, depending on our disposition, faith. That immaterial part, which we could call soul or spirit, but in his spirit, he speaks mysteries. In his spirit means he doesn't have a personal comprehension. He's speaking with his spirit. He's exercising the gift. He chose with his will to exercise the gift, but he doesn't know what he said. Reminds me of a lot of people I know. I should have said that. Reminds me of me sometimes, though. Sometimes I say something, I say, what in the world was I talking about? And when he does this, he speaks something that's a mystery, or it's not revealed to him. Okay, make sense so far? But the one who prophesies speaks to people, the people that are present, that are like him, that don't know the language that he would speak in if he spoke in tongues, but they know the language he'd speak in if he prophesied. So when he prophesies, he does speak to people, those present of like language. And they're edified, they're exhorted, they're consoled. Makes sense, right? If you just understand, known language, sign, it all falls in place. Verse 4. No one speaks in a tongue, no one who speaks in a tongue edifies himself. Why? He doesn't know what he said. He's speaking in a language he never learned, he doesn't use. He can't build himself up. The one who speaks in a tongue doesn't edify himself by the tongue. How does he edify himself then? The one who speaks in a tongue edifies himself. Can't do that with the unknown part, right? But the word edify here doesn't mean he has to understand in this context. Sometimes, and boy, next week's when it gets really exciting to me. This is academic. Next week it starts getting practical and personal and exciting. So if you're hanging on for that, hang on another week. When I exercise my gift of teaching, I know that people are edified, but I don't always know it. There's plenty of sermons I preached and I walked out off the pulpit thinking, man, that was a dud day. If anybody got anything out of that mess, good luck. And I, you know, over the years, tradition, Baptist churches, you go to the back door and you shake hands, everybody goes. I suppose you all do it too, but you have multiple doors. We just have one door, you know. So people going out the door, and every week, people say, well, appreciate it, great sermon. You know, it just goes in one ear and out the other. And they're just saying that, you know, what's expected. But invariably, on one of those weeks, when I feel like I preached the worst sermon I've ever preached in my life, some person who never says anything when they go out the door stops and says, Pastor, the Spirit of God really got a hold of you at this point. But it wasn't me. I didn't know I edified anybody, but I sure am glad that I did it. So the person can speak in a tongue, not know what he said, and edify himself because he knows he's exercising a gift. And that's why I had to come to look at those dead sermons. I exercised a gift best I could. Maybe it wasn't the best I ever did, the best I could at the moment. And I know that that fulfills my calling, so it makes me feel edified and built up. It encourages me. So that's what you're seeing. The one who speaks in a tongue edifies himself by exercising his gift. Boy, I wish that guy had learned to spell. But the one who prophesies edifies the church for sure. Because no interpretation is needed for prophecy. Now here's where interpreters get all messed up too, because they think he's talking about preaching. Well, prophecy is equated with preaching. When you're prophesying, you're preaching. But unfortunately today there's no gift of prophecy. So when we preach, we're not prophesying. We have all the prophecy we need that we can elaborate on. But in that day, they were synonymous, basically. Verse 5. Now I wish you all spoke in tongues, but rather that you would prophesy, and greater is the one who prophesies than the one who speaks in tongues, unless he interprets, so the church will receive edification. Does all this fall into place?
Well, go back to that one more time. I'm probably the only one that didn't get it.
No, I don't think so.
5. Go back and explain that again.
Verse 5?
Yep.
He says, now I wish that you all spoke in tongues. In other words, I'm happy for you to speak in tongues. I want you to do what you've been gifted to do. I wish you would do that. But he's limiting the use. Okay? He's not saying, I wish you'd do it even though there's no interpreter. He said, I wish you'd do it in general. I don't want you to stop, but I want you to make sure you know how to use it. But rather, that you would prophesy, if there is no one present that can understand and have a sign, I'd rather you prophesy and not use the gift. Limitation. And greater is the one who prophesies. Doesn't mean greater in their person, but greater in usage here. It's better, it's greater, it's more profitable to prophesy when there's no one there that needs a sign, because if you use tongues and there's no one that can understand it, that doesn't give you the same value. Greater is the one who prophesies than the one who speaks in tongues. Unless there's someone there who interprets the tongues. Then both are lifted on the same level. That help? Sometimes I answer questions, but I don't know if I answered your question.
Everybody else in the room, I'm sure, has it, understands it.
I just want to make sure that you've got an answer that suits you. I'm not sure I gave it.
Well, I guess sometimes I look at that and I say, okay, that suggests that prophecy will not cease. Or are we just talking about that moment in time when people were still prophesying?
Don't confuse long-term end-time prophecy with what we talked about when we talked about the gift of prophecy. They were able to instruct people about what they should do or what's going to happen to them in their immediate future. Remember that? He told Philip to go talk to the man on the chariot. I remember the others. Agabus told him there's a famine coming, prepare for it. Those were things that I think is referenced here. Either that, I mean, it could be referencing prophecies that had already been given as well, Old Testament. But don't think about prophecies encompassing all the end time. Does that help?
I guess the bottom line is, as I read this, is he's saying, you know, among the gifts, have a gift, exercise a gift that will bless everyone in the body.
That's the bottom line.
That will strengthen, will encourage everyone in the body. And tongues could lead to confusion, or particularly if there's no interpretation. But prophecy is really spoken in the plain English.
That's exactly what it means, exactly. You've got it, as far as I'm concerned.
One other note on that is that in verse 28, it says, if there's no interpreter, the speaker should keep quiet in the church and speak to himself and to God. Which suggests that there's no interpreter.
It's a limitation on the tongues part, not the prophecy.
Right.
Exactly. All right, now let's move forward. But now, brothers and sisters, if I come to you speaking in tongues, how will it benefit you unless I speak to you either by way of known stuff, plain stuff, revelation, knowledge, prophecy, teaching, all which need no interpretation, my comment. Yet, even lifeless instruments, whether flute or harp, in producing the sound, if they do not produce a distinction in the tones, how will it be known what is played on the flute or the harp? Or if the trumpet produces an indistinct sound, then who will prepare himself for battle? So you too, unless you produce intelligible speech by the tongue, how will it be known what is spoken? In other words, don't use tongues if there's no one there to interpret it. For you will be just talking to the air. Now this is the New American Standard Translation. Did you say to God, maybe again? Maybe that might be a previous New American Standard. I'm not sure. But the translation here, to the air, just means from a human perspective. That's all we can see. Obviously, God can understand that, as mentioned earlier. It's pretty general here. Just follow up, explanation, illustration. Verse 10, there are perhaps... all that know how many. There are perhaps a great many kinds of languages across the known world. But it's not the word tongues. You might look at this and say, well, that's the word tongues they're just now translating it right now. translating it different, they leave tongues, tongues in the translation. Here they use language. We saw them use the languages in Acts 2, it meant dialect. Here it doesn't even mean dialect, it just means sound. It's from the Greek word phonēs, or sound. There are perhaps a great many kinds of sounds, not languages. So the interpreters are saying, perhaps there's a great many languages, Paul doesn't know them all in his language. That's what the interpreters say, but what I'm saying to you, the Greek simply says sounds. So Paul says, perhaps there's a great many sounds, a lot more sounds than I understand, in the world. And none are incapable of meaning. Not the flute, not the harp, not the trumpet, not your words, controlled by your mind. So I do not know the meaning of the sound. If I do not know the meaning of the sound, my interpretation here, based on the literal Greek, I will be unintelligible. If I don't know what the sound means, I will be unintelligible. Does it mean? Let me stop. This is hard to. Let me start over again. So if I do not know the meaning of the sound, I will be not unintelligible. It's the Greek word a foreigner. It doesn't mean it's not understandable, because somebody can understand it, even if it's a tongue somewhere, somebody can understand it. But he says, if I do not know the meaning of the language, the tongue I speak, I will be a foreigner to the one who speaks. And the one who speaks will be not unintelligible, but a foreigner to me. It's not that nobody can understand it, but we're foreign to each other. That's all he's saying. So, you too, since you are eager to possess spiritual gifts, strive to excel for the edification of the church. Let's just make sure we understand when he says strive. I think it's a Greek word for seek. Seek to excel. Seek to do the right thing. Seek to do the most profitable thing, which would include controlling how you use tongues. Use your spiritual gifts, but seek to excel. That means to abound, to be in abundance, to bless as much as possible, to have as much positive, edifying effect. So seek to abound for the edification of the church. Don't insist on speaking in a tongue if nobody can interpret, if nobody there has the gift of interpretation. They were allowed to speak in a tongue if there was somebody there who could interpret it, even if there was nobody that needed to sign.
That suggests to me that a person could just turn it on and off as he will, rather than the Spirit directing him.
Well, yes. I wrestled with that same thing. And this does indicate they could turn it on and off. They could decide when to speak in tongues. But that doesn't leave out the Spirit prompting them to do it. The question is, just like for us, am I doing what I think I should do, or am I doing what really the Spirit's prompting me to do? We have to. Yeah. We can't discern that very well either. So, yeah, but you're right. And there was a point where, prompted by the Spirit or not, they chose to speak in tongues. They still didn't understand what they said. That was the gift. Pretty miraculous how this all operated. Therefore, one who speaks in a tongue is to pray he may interpret. Now, this has boggled my mind for a long time. This is not saying the one who speaks in a tongue should pray that he could interpret. Then it wouldn't be a tongue, really. They wouldn't be speaking in something he didn't know. And it, was he going to turn around asking God for the gift then to interpret what he would? The one who speaks in a tongue should pray that. This is a Greek use. The Greek use of the word that, or the conjunction hina, means result. It doesn't mean immediate purpose. And it's in the present tense. What it means is, if someone chooses to turn it over their mind and speak in a tongue, they better be praying somebody's there to dirt. In fact, they should always pray. Well, even before going to church, But that would be the case. And if they're not aware of anybody interpreting, be quiet. That's all that's talking about. And pray that for the general result that he, who's the he? That the one speaking, he's the he. That's the confusing part. Not the one interpreting. That he may interpret. Well, how can he interpret without an interpreter? Because he doesn't have the gift of interpretation. Or not necessarily does. So the use of the word interpret here means simply that he and others present could understand what he had spoken through interpretation. It doesn't mean there's some spiritual value to praying in tongues. That's what the charismatics say. It's not what he's saying. When you look at the words and grammar.
The NIV says they, instead of he and others. The NIV says they may interpret, which I don't know what that exact language is, but it could mean that, could mean
you,
they could.
Your interpretation is that they may interpret?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, that's a suggestion. I don't know what the words are, but they could.
Look, it's a singular in the Greek. So I think it has to go back to the one speaking. By the way, the one who speaks is a participle. I mean, the one who exercises gift over a long period of time, he keeps on speaking and speaking and speaking. That's the Greek present tense. The one who speaks tongues over the course of his Christian experience should always all at the same time be praying there'll be interpreters present. If it's done in a place where there's people that are not hearing it in their own time. So let's think of it in that terms. Therefore, one who speaks in a tongue is to pray that the result may be that he eventually will himself understand it through an interpreter. Wish I'd have said it that way on my note. That's what I'm trying to say there. It's not saying there were people praying in an unknown tongue that nobody on earth could understand but God. That's not what he's saying. Or if I pray in a tongue, you can pray in a tongue. But he's not saying we need to pray in a tongue nobody on earth can understand. He's saying if you exercise your gift of tongue, whether you're teaching, praying, witnessing, whatever you're doing, be praying that you can understand it so you can have multiple or maximum edification too. That would have to come through an interpreter. For if I pray in a tongue, my spirit prays, just like when you speak in a tongue, your spirit speaks. But my mind is unproductive, meaning my mind or what I intended to communicate or what I can comprehend. I didn't change the slides, different on yours, I hope. For if I pray in a tongue, my spirit prays, but my mind, and I put something different. What's your say?
Without comprehension.
That was one of my last minute things this morning. I thought I got to, I didn't get to. Unproductive. The word meaning is unfruitful. You don't have that. I'm not very necessary to make that note. What is the outcome then, says Paul? In the Greek, it simply says, what then is it? I will pray with, what's the application? That's what he's saying. I will pray with the Spirit, meaning in the future, I determine to go on speaking in tongues. I will pray with the Spirit, but I will pray with my mind also. I've determined in the future, I'm going to do it in the right way with the right constraints. And I will sing in the Spirit, I'll sing with my mind also. That is in the context of the church where there's people there that don't get the sign. For otherwise, if you bless God in the Spirit only, how will the one who occupies the place of an outsider, one not knowing the one who occupies the place of an outsider would be someone who speaks the same language as the person speaking in tongues who doesn't understand. So you're putting yourself in the place of an outsider. Can't understand it. So how will the one who occupies the place of the outsider, one not knowing the language spoken, how will they say amen at your giving of thanks and so on? Finally, Paul concludes by saying, nevertheless, in the church, I prefer to speak five words with my mind so that I may instruct others also, but all, that is everybody, instruct others, not just the one who needs a sign, rather than 10,000 words at a time. Don't have the wrong emphasis on this thing. I'm going to stop there because I got done early last week, so you guys got to give me an extra 5 or 10 this week, right? And that's going to go to you if you have a question. And believe me, if you have a question that you just chew on all week, well, you asked it next week at the beginning. That's okay. So if you've got something burning right now, go ahead.
Did you do E?
Hmm?
Did you do E?
E. The gift of interpretation provided edification to those present. E, edification is the feeling. Okay, now we'll go to the question.
I had a friend a long time ago. He spoke in tongues, or he said he did. And I, you know, always had the problem was that when you hang around charismatic people and when we are praying, we sometimes use tongues. And it kind of always bothered me. So I read a comment that somebody said, well, if you have the gift of tongues and you speak it, why don't you record it? Okay? And then give it to somebody who wasn't there but has a gift of interpretation. And if you give it to three people who have the gift of interpretation, should come up with the same answer. Because, you know, language is a language.
That is an incredibly insightful comment. And you remembered it.
Nobody ever come up with the thing and said, well, I have a recording. You have the gift of interpretation. And give it to three people independently and let them interpret what it says. If they come up with the same thing, well, you got a point, but...
So, that's incredibly insightful, and thank you for sharing that. And that just reminds me of something I need to say. I hate to take away from the time I just gave you. The people who pray to God in tongues today, and they don't understand what the word means, and neither does anybody else, that's what Paul's saying, don't do. And I don't doubt their sincerity. They are offering praise to God in some context. I'm not doubting the fact they love God. I'm just saying, whatever it is they're doing, it's not what we find in Scripture. Mm-hmm. And there's people that love the Lord, I have no doubt, that are saved, and they do a lot of good for Christ, and they do that.
But there are those in some churches, I'm not saying the church doctrine, but there are people in some churches that are charismatic, that feel that unless you speak in tongues, you're not saved.
And that becomes judgmental, and that's not productive, yes. So it can be just like anything else. It could be something sincere and something that's warped.
But the scripture also says, if you're in distress and you don't know what to say, the Lord knows, and your spirit will communicate in groanings, not knowing to anybody, not even knowing to you, but it's between your spirit and the Lord, so he can, you know, is that kind of a tongue too? I mean, you know, it's between you and the Lord. You don't know how to express yourself, but your spirit knows and communicates with the Lord.
I'm going to compare it like this. And this is the way I've always looked at that. There's times in life when you're so overwhelmed with problems and confusion, you don't know what to do, you don't know how to handle it, you don't know what to do about it. And sometimes I could just come to an end of talking, and I don't know what to ask God for. I don't even know what the right thing is. I just have to submit myself, Lord, thy will be done. And I think my spirit then probably does communicate with his spirit. I don't even know what it is, but I don't think it's, and I know you don't either, but I don't think it's this, but I think it's something akin to what I just described. I know you didn't need that question answered, but for everybody's sake, that was a good reference to dimension to them to come on the people's bars.
I kind of think of it, because I do that a lot. I think of it as my heart communicating with God.
Yeah.
He knows what I...
That doesn't require gibberish coming out of your mouth to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. But some people think it does, and that's just a limited misunderstanding, I think.
Again, I'm going to say again on verse 28, if there is no interpreter, the speaker should keep quiet in the church and speak to himself and to God.
And that eliminates, as far as I can tell, 100% charismatic experience of tongues in the church, like that.
Well, if I'm going to share up here, there need 5 people in there. Nobody knows what they're saying. Yeah. They need to show me the scripture. Well, no, that's not what that means.
That's because they approach the whole thing we just went over from their own presupposition.
Exactly.
Or they've been told that it means this.
I'm gonna say it's good today. Let's do this.
And what good is that? What good is that except?
Very true. Anybody else? I'm going to dismiss you. Those of you who need to go, go. If people want to hang around, you can ask me.
Can understand it. What good is it doing?
Personally, I think it's probably the best way to go at this point. Don't you think, Ms. Brown?
Can we pick up on this?
Yeah, you can pick up on that next week, too.